Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thinking outside the box isn't easy, and neuroscientists are just beginning to understand why. The brains of real out-of-the-box iconoclasts, Branch Rickey, Steve Jobs, Florence Nightingale, might actually be wired to think differently. But there is hope for the rest of us, ways to steer around the biological roadblocks that get in the way of our free imaginations. This hour, On Point neuroscientist Gregory Burns on breaking out of the box. You can join the conversation. What does it take to get you thinking outside the box? Do you believe you're hardwired for it or against it? Joining me now from Atlanta, Georgia, is Dr. Gregory Burns. He is director of the Center for Neuropolicy and chair of neuroeconomics at Emory University, where he's a professor in the departments of psychiatry and economics, as well as at the Gazzetta Business School. His new book, out October 1st, is Iconoclast: A Neuroscientist Reveals How to Think Differently. Dr. Burns, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Neuroeconomics? What the heck is that?
You know, I get that a lot. And usually that's kind of the icebreaker at the cocktail party. But, neuroeconomics is a new field that was born probably about 4 or 5 years ago when a small group of neuroscientists got together with a small group of economists and actually some people from Wall Street to discuss the possibility that understanding what goes on in the human brain might have something to say about how people make decisions. And that was the birth of neuroeconomics, and it's really exploded since then.
Okay, Wall Street and a whole lot more going on right now has us hungry for out-of-the-box thinking. So what have you learned bringing neuroscience and economics and what behavioral science to bear on your subject here, which I guess is really innovation, something iconoclasts often do?
Yeah, you know, I define an iconoclast as someone who does something that other people say can't be done. And that's really, I would say, the extremist form of innovation. And, you know, there's certainly shades of innovation, but the book is really about the people who are out there in the, you know, the tails of the distribution, the top 1%. And listening to the last hour, I can tell you that a lot of people out there want change, and yeah, I agree. It would be great to have some iconoclasts in leadership positions in this country. But one of the things that I discuss in this book is that that's not likely to happen, certainly not coming from politicians. And the reason is because, for the most part, our brains never evolved to be iconoclasts. And frankly, most people aren't.
Take us into that. The brain and iconoclasts, are you saying that? And you go through a lot of stories here of particular individuals, names many people will recognize here. From Martin Luther King and Henry Ford and Warren Buffett and Arnold Schwarzenegger to, you know, Nolan Bushnell and Richard Feynman, lots of people. But are you saying that great innovators, iconoclasts, out-of-the-box thinkers have different brains than the rest of us, different brain structure, brain chemistry, or that they somehow interact with their brains differently?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, there just aren't a lot of iconoclasts in our midst, and it's really the rare individual who comes up with, a novel idea that tears down existing ways of thought and puts something new in its place. Now, I think that the people who do that, you know, not only do they tell us something important about where new ideas come from and how everyone else might get a little piece of that and learn something from that, but it also speaks to the fact that it's not the norm. And the reason I argue is because our brains never really evolved to think differently from each other. So there's a couple of reasons for that, and I break it down into actually three different components of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
The first is what we call perception. And perception simply refers to the psychological and biological process that our brains do that converts things coming in from the senses into what we would call a mental image.
Mm-hmm.
So for most people, we're talking about visual imagery, and a lot of ideas come from imagining things in a very visual way. Now, it turns out that we actually know quite a lot about how imagination works in the brain. And it turns out that imagination uses the same parts of the brains as it does for perception. So the example that I like to give for this is imagine a sunset. So we can kind of play this game. So you can sit there and imagine a sunset.
I'm doing it right now. Okay.
Okay. And I'll hazard a guess and say that you're probably imagining kind of an orange sun setting peacefully over an ocean.
No, I was picturing a particular one. I saw a great sunset over the Rocky Mountains recently. We were out in Denver doing the show. It was fantastic. It was unusual.
Okay. Well, so you surprised me there. But the exercise is important because sunsets are – people have seen sunsets so many times. You've seen thousands of sunsets. And there's actually very little surprise in a sunset. I mean, you get the occasional one, but more or less they happen the same. And when you ask people to imagine them, most people will imagine them in kind of a fairly generic way.
A kind of Hallmark way. Or maybe another example, I mean, you cite Vincent van Gogh here. You could say imagine a night sky, and then we all know what he imagined with the starry night sky.
Exactly. And where perception comes from is it's not simply kind of just stuff streaming into your eyes like a video camera and you just kind of read it out mentally. A lot of the process of perception, which is essentially the same as imagination, comes from past experience. And so I use the sunset example because it's actually very hard to think of a completely novel sunset.
So you're saying even when we perceive a sunset, we're kind of imposing a hallmark or stereotype sunset on it? Well, that's part of
Absolutely.
What we're seeing?
Absolutely. And it's unavoidable. So, and the reason we do this is because our brains evolved to do what they do very efficiently. So the brain has to run on the equivalent of about 40 watts of energy. You know, that's a light bulb and not even a very bright one. And so to accomplish everything that we do during the day, the brain has to multitask. But it does it in a very efficient way, and it does it by taking shortcuts. And I call this the efficiency principle. So one thing that has recently been measured is what the bandwidth of the human eye is.
Okay.
So the bandwidth meaning how fast you can pump information
from the eye. How much data it processes, pulls in,
Yeah, so that's easily measured. And it turns out that the eye transmits information to the brain at about 1 megabit per second, which is not even the speed of a fast cable modem these days.
Okay.
So think about that. We're going through our day. You know, we're able to navigate traffic, do all the things that we do, you know, sipping information through a straw.
And so the brain has to take shortcuts to make sense of what's going on, what's typically going on, or assume what's going on.
Well, that's what the brain does. It makes lots of assumptions about what it's seeing, and it only processes things that deviate from its expectations.
But some people look out at the world, whether the world or you use the example of Walt Disney with film, and see or imagine very different presentations or uses for what's streaming in at that 1 megabit a second through the human eye.
Exactly. And that's where iconoclasm and innovation begins. And it begins with perception because in order to think creatively, the brain has to get out of this predictive efficiency mode.
Give us the example of Disney. What did he do?
Well, Disney was started his career as an illustrator, actually. In World War I, he drew cartoons to amuse himself and the troops. And after World War I, he returned home to Kansas City and started an illustration business where he drew ads for a local theater. Now, around the 1920s and 30s, cartoons were used primarily as an advertising medium.
Okay.
So before the films would start, and this would still be in the silent era, they would show these still life cartoons on the screen, and they would typically be selling products. Mm-hmm. And that would be kind of the entree into the main feature. So Disney was working, kind of eking out a career, working out of a garage that his parents owned. And as he was making these cartoons and watching them come up on the screen, something triggered a new way of looking at the problem. So keep in mind that what was coming into his eyes was still the same. But something novel happened, and he realized, he said, why can't these cartoons, why can't these things that I'm drawing be the main feature and have it the other way around?
So he was seeing the same technology, seeing the same flickering images, but imagining them used in a very different way.
Yeah, and it was the thing that triggered it for him. And typically, perceptions get changed by something novel happening. That's actually the most effective way to trigger a new perception and a new idea. And the thing that triggered it was simply seeing the things that he was drawing on in his studio on a piece of paper or celluloid and seeing it up on the screen. That was novel for him. He hadn't seen that before. And when he saw it projected on the screen, that triggered a new possibility. He began to see things not as the Hallmark sunset, but he saw something completely different. He saw his pictures on a screen and said, gee, I could be the main feature.
Yes, sir. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay. My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
Oh, plenty of sunshine in the wind, in the land.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about thinking outside the box, innovation, iconoclasm, breakout thinking, and the neuroscience that impedes it or drives it. My guest is Dr. Gregory Burns. He joins us from Atlanta. He's author of the new book, Iconoclast, A Neuroscientist Reveals How to Think Differently. And Lord knows, right now, maybe we need a big dose of that. Dr. Burns, you point first at perception. You say we have to be careful that the brain, because it needs efficiency to get a lot done on 40 watts, looks for efficiencies by kind of superimposing preconceptions on what it sees out in the world. What else do you look to when it comes to neuroscience and breaking open the brain for innovation?
Well, the second bit of innovation and iconoclasm is actually very relevant today, and that is fear. Mm-hmm. So one of the great businessmen of the 19th century, I love this quote. This is from Henry Ford.
Okay.
And this is appropriate today. He said, thinking first of money instead of work brings on fear of failure, and this fear blocks every avenue of business. It makes a man afraid of competition, of changing his methods, or doing anything which might change his condition.
Okay.
And I love that quote because...
Cold sweats about money.
Yeah. Well, he was talking about money, but really what he was saying is that the fear of losing what you have, losing the status quo, is one of the greatest inhibitors of change and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And he is so right. So what we know about the fear response in the brain is that because the brain is doing things as efficiently as possible, it tends to resist change because anytime something changes, that means something new and you have to adapt. The brain has to rewire connections, and that's hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll tell you, this book, I wrote this book kind of out of somewhat, I would say, the failure of my first book, which is an interesting story because in the first book, I wrote a lot about the neurotransmitter dopamine. And dopamine, most people have heard of, is a neurotransmitter closely associated with pleasure.
Right.
Turns out that it's not really about pleasure. It's about anticipation and expectation. And anything that triggers its release sets up a state of anticipation, which can be good or bad.
Okay.
But the things that release dopamine tend to be novel and surprising.
Mm-hmm.
And we've known this for about 10 years from neuroscientific studies. So I argued in the last book that, aha, what the brain really wants is novelty.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this book, and I went around the country, and I talked to people about it. And
mm-hmm.
I came to the unfortunate realization that I might not be right about that. Because I would tell people that, and they would look at me and say, novelty? I don't like novelty. You know, I like to go to the same restaurant and order the same thing every time. I just want to retire to the beach and relax. Except, you know, there would always be one or two people in an audience who said, ah, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I thrive on novelty. I thrive on challenge. And that's what I want out of life.
So are you saying that when you look at the brain, how it works, that it's a small percentage who are always going to be innovators, iconoclasts? Is that just the way it is? And everyone else is going to lean toward the status quo, against change, novelty, surprise?
I would say it's a small percentage who have a natural affinity for challenge and novelty, and those are the iconoclasts. And, you know, we all have to kind of face the issue of, you know, how much change do we want in our life, and, you know, how much change are we willing to embrace in order to take risks and actually create new enterprises, new art, new technology. And you need to do that. Henry Ford realized that. He says as soon as you become afraid of losing what you have, that blocks all avenues of innovation and advancement.
Let's look at a couple of other examples, if we could, here. You cite, in looking at iconoclasts who have broken through on perception, we talked about Walt Disney. You talk about Branch Rickey. Now, how do you see him there?
Branch Rickey is a hero of mine. Branch Rickey originally was the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals and was tapped by the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 40s to basically bring a pennant back to Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Branch Rickey, among many of his innovations, he created the minor league farm system that we all know today as a way to groom players and bring them up to the majors. But the thing that really stands out in my mind and you know, kind of elevates him to the level of being called the Mahatma, which was his nickname, was that he was the one who hired Jackie Robinson.
Broke the color line.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was a kind of a famous unwritten rule in Major League Ball then that said an African-American would never play in the majors. And this came down from the commissioner himself, mm-hmm. Kennesaw Mountain Landis.
Mm-hmm.
And he would always deny that, but it was an unwritten rule. And what Branch Rickey did, and part of this was out of necessity. It was out of economic necessity in large part because many of the ball players were drafted into the Army during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Rickey saw the Negro Leagues as a good place to get good ball players. And so part of it was practical, but you bet, you know, he and Jackie Robinson had to endure a substantial amount of fear of failure, and in case of Jackie Robinson's case, you know, fear for his life, in order to actually make this happen. And, you know, Branch Rickey was kind of very stoic and believed very solidly in his beliefs and stood by them and essentially acknowledged this as a potential fear, but did not let it rule his actions.
But he didn't have a neuroscientist standing at his elbow saying, you know, it's just a habit and the brain's hunger for efficiency that keeps us all thinking in color terms around baseball. He somehow just broke through. What makes him or people like him or men or women, you know, who do things like that, what enables them to do it? Do you think that they're born with a different brain chemistry or is it something else?
Well, having spoken to a lot of iconoclasts, I can tell you that some are born into it. Some just are naturally wired that way. And some people, I think, kind of learn it or fall into it either accidentally or by circumstances. Branch Rickey was probably a little bit of both. But the thing that we can all take away from it is acknowledging where the fear comes from. We know the part of the brain that's responsible for fear. It's called the amygdala. It operates very quickly, even subconsciously. But the thing is, it's not necessarily a hardwired response that means that we're always going to be afraid. It can be overridden by what we would call conscious thought, which is a different part of the brain. And, you know, I think what Branch Rickey did, and certainly he felt some fear. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if he would acknowledge that, but certainly there was the fear of uncertainty.
Sure.
And one of the best ways that we know of, you know, from modern neuroscience to control fear is to simply reframe the problem at hand in a different light. I mean, we have sayings for this, right? You know, when life hands you lemons, you make lemonade out of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The technical name for that is called cognitive reappraisal. Mm-hmm. And what that means is it's taking the prefrontal cortex, the front part of our brains, which is kind of really the cognitive part, the higher thought, and looking at the situation differently. So this gets back to perception.
Right.
So the facts are the same, but it's how you interpret them mm-hmm. that you can change.
Turn them a different way, look from a different angle.
Right, and that can essentially inhibit the fear response. So I'm not saying that iconoclasts don't have fear. It's just that they don't let it rule their actions.
Dr. Burns, let me bring our listeners in. A lot of them are responding here, and I want to hear from them, if I may. From Rigby, Idaho, we've got Jim calling. Hi, Jim. You're on the air with Dr. Gregory Burns.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, sir. What's on your mind, Jim?
Well, I was just going to say that I'm a retired aerospace engineer, and back in my late 20s, I was working in research and development. And I had a couple of situations where there was no fear involved. I had something to prove to my supervisor with whom I shared an office. And we finally patented that thing. He had been teaching transistor subjects at UCLA.
Yeah.
And he had said that what I had thought would not work, and I knew it would work. So I had to prove to him mathematically that it would work. That worked. And then another situation, there had to be an easier way to design a computer, which was what we were doing. And so that developed a line of products that they set up another division of another company for me to market those particular products. But none of it had to do with fear, or it was just what I saw in my mind was possible.
But Jim, there you were, you're in your young 20s, aerospace research engineer. Your boss said what you're envisioning won't work, and you had the kind of iconoclastic mind to want to bust through and prove that it would. Were you always out of the box? Was it just in your nature? Was it his challenge that it wouldn't work that pushed you to prove that it would? What?
Well, it's my nature. I was R&D engineer for over 30 years, and that's what I did. Innovating was my job.
Jim, thanks very much. Dr. Burns, what do you say to this story? Jim remembers it very well. It ended up sounded like both in the innovation and the marketing of it, he was quite effective. It worked for him, and innovation wasn't a rare thing for him. It was his job.
Well, that's a great story, and it actually kind of reminds me of another story. It's actually more of a cautionary tale, and that is the story of Edwin Armstrong, who was also an engineer. And Edwin Armstrong actually was the person who invented FM radio.
Okay.
And
God bless him.
Yes, exactly. and FM, he worked 10 years on this technology. He actually made key advancements in AM radio, too. Mm-hmm. And he worked with the president of RCA, David Sarnoff, at the time, to help install the first radio transmitter on top of the Empire State Building. Now, what Armstrong did, he spent 10 years working on FM technology because he was convinced that it was superior to AM mm-hmm. because it had higher fidelity, primarily because it had higher fidelity.
Yep.
And nobody believed him. And what happened was, in fact, it was superior. He was right. But the problem was that he was unable to convince anyone of its superiority, and he ended up killing himself because of it, even though the technology was subsequently adopted about a year after his death. So the story we just heard actually, I think, is a positive story because it points kind of to the third area of innovation and iconoclasm, which is key, which is you can have the best idea in the world. It can be completely novel and innovative. But if you can't sell the idea to anyone else, you might as well not have thought of it. And that's what we call social intelligence.
And you look there, and you have heroes or examples like Picasso, Van Gogh, Ray Kroc, founder of McDonald's, Schwarzenegger, you put in this category, Warren Buffett, all blessed with kind of social networking skills that what? Don't leave them isolated with their innovative thoughts, but give them the capacity to convey, convince.
Absolutely. So if we acknowledge that most people do not like change to any substantial degree, then being an iconoclast means that you have to kind of change people's minds. And that's not easy. So I like to compare Picasso and Van Gogh, because we can all agree that they were both iconoclasts. They both created artwork that is just out of this world,
yep.
And they changed the art world. Picasso died a very wealthy man. His estate was huge.
Mm-hmm.
He was extremely popular. Van Gogh died broke.
With
not
one
even
ear.
A penny.
Right.
With one ear. And if you go by kind of the current value of their artwork, it's about the same.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they both fetch about the same amount of money
mm-hmm.
per painting.
Mm-hmm.
The difference was that Van Gogh, of course, was just, you know, he was repugnant from a social perspective. He hated everyone. Everyone hated him. He was mentally ill. And he couldn't sell his ideas, even if he wanted to. And I would say that for people who want to be innovators and iconoclasts, you know, we want to emulate Picasso, not Van Gogh.
You also put the Dixie Chicks in here as exemplars when it comes to innovation. Which side of the line do they fall on, the Picasso or Van Gogh?
Not quite sure. I guess time will tell about that. But the thing that impresses me about the Dixie Chicks, of course, is the whole episode from several years ago when Natalie Maines remarked that they were ashamed that President Bush was from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of the resultant firestorm was that, you know, a lot of radios banned their songs. People start protesting.
This was out of the box at that time, especially politically, for people in the sort of country singing category.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that is extremely iconoclastic for that particular musical genre. And they suffered. And the thing that struck me about their story was the intense fear that they suffered because their lives were threatened. And yet they persisted on, and they stayed true to their beliefs and continued to perform and make music.
So what do you imagine if you were doing an MRI of their brains? And I know you do. You do that as part of your research. Would you have seen something neurologically going on with Natalie Maines that you didn't with, hey, I don't know, Toby Keith?
Well, the generic or prototypical fear response is pretty clear in the brain. There's, you know, these two structures, the amygdala, that get set off anytime you see something fearful. And, you know, probably they would be going off, you know, certainly if my life was threatened, you'd see my amygdala going off. And the issue is that you would probably also see, in Natalie Maines' case, her prefrontal cortex going off because, you know, it had to inhibit that response and keep it under control.
And so, with that kind of override, maybe it gave her the mental room, the emotional room to say what she was thinking.
I would say the mental stamina and resilience and courage. I think that's what courage is. You know, it's overriding that fear response and carrying on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about thinking outside the box, about innovation, iconoclasm, breakout thinking, and the neuroscience that impedes it or may drive it. My guest is Dr. Gregory Burns. He's professor in Emory University's Departments of Psychology and Economics. He's author of the new book, Iconoclast, A Neuroscientist Reveals How to Think Differently. He's a chair for neuropolicy and chair of neuroeconomics at Emory University and joins us from Atlanta. We've got a lot of people lining up with questions and comments. Let's go first to Bill in Newton, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to jump right in with some outside-box thinking of my own,
please.
I guess.
Please, yeah.
I'm a fan of the sociobiology doctrine by E.O. Wilson and
mm-hmm.
look at iconoclastic behavior in animal populations. And schooling behavior in fish, as a neuroscientist, I think you can probably appreciate the amazing complexity of that very rapid group dynamic interaction that's regulated by a poorly understood sort of neurological foundation along the lateral flanks of the fish. There's specialized neuronal cells that communicate and create almost an entire organism out of this large group.
And when that school turns in the water at that flashing, almost it looks like the speed of light, it would take some brave or crazy fish not to turn with it.
Well, that's right, and that's also very protective in the face of a predator like a shark. They all of a sudden look like a large organism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the lone iconoclast fish mm-hmm. that now becomes very vulnerable, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue is, are we not, I mean, we like to think of ourselves as dissociated from schooling behavior in fish and birds and other animals that have clear flocking types of behavior.
But maybe we aren't
are
so
we
different.
Really? But mm-hmm. are we really different?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bill, stick with us. Gregory Burns, great question. We've all seen what happens with schools of fish and flocks of birds. Are we really so different in our own neurobiology?
That is a great example, Bill, and you know, you said it better than I could. I mean, gee, look at Wall Street. Looks like a school of fish to me. But seriously, you know, I don't see, and this is why I start off by saying that I don't think that there are that many true iconoclasts out there because, I mean, mm-hmm. the example you gave says that that fish who decides to go his own way, he probably got eaten. And so evolution probably, you know, is a pretty good mechanism of weeding out people who have this tendency to, you know, really go off on a tangent from what everyone else is doing. And I think it's true of the human brain as well. Now, we might have a little more capacity to override our tendencies to go along with the herd. But the example you gave is great because it shows that, you know, even for humans, and humans evolved in very social environments, you know, even 10,000 years ago, there's a strong pressure to think like everyone else does. And there are a couple reasons for that. One is that from just a statistical perspective, a group is more likely to be right than you are. So there's good, you know, there's a good reason to go along with everyone else because they probably know something you don't.
Except when they're wrong, and over the cliff we go.
Except when they're wrong, and everyone just goes over the cliff. Exactly. So one of evolution's great mechanisms for kind of preventing that kind of mass behavior is there will always be people that go against the herd, and it's just an adaptive response to evolution that there's always kind of a stable mix of, for lack of a better word, sheeps and iconoclasts. And there will always be iconoclasts because, you know, for whatever reason, their genes are perhaps a little bit different. They're willing to take a few extra risks. And sometimes they get lucky and, you know, they profit fantastically from it.
Mm. Caller Bill, if I may, you've done the research on fish, but, you know, fish basically, as far as I know or can imagine, have schooled in the same way for eons. Humans do a lot of things the same, but we see cultural evolution at the same time. Does that suggest to you that we're different from schooling fish or flocking birds?
Well, actually, I don't do research on fish. Uh-huh. I've just, you know, you had a caller that was talking about, you know, their experience in R&D. And
yeah.
I'm a scientist in genetics, mm-hmm. and you can see schooling behavior in these kinds of fields that seem to pride themselves on iconoclast, but by you know, the absence of rewarding iconoclastic behavior. I mean, we in our midst had Judah Folkman, who was a pioneer in the field of angiogenesis, blood vessel formation, and the role that that would play in tumor development. And he was shunned by the scientific community for decades. Unfortunately, he passed away long before he received the full accolades of his research. But this is a mainstream type of thing now. And so I think that it's really ingrained. It's hard to get away from it. Even the iconoclasts that somehow do what that caller did and prove their theories right,
mm-hmm.
they ultimately end up imposing a very strict type of conformity on the people that come behind them, like Ray Kroc and McDonald's.
Right. You will make the cheeseburger this way.
Well, and he was an iconoclast sort of entrepreneur that created
sure.
fast food in America.
Sure.
Now McDonald's is the ultimate, you know, statement of conformity.
Yeah, Bill, you're wonderful. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Burns, what about this issue? You say there seems to be a kind of steady state population of iconoclasts within a population. You've got some advice here on how to maybe pump that number up a bit, but do you see waves in communities or cultures or countries, periods where the community environment is more or less nurturing to iconoclasm, innovation, and what could tweak it up or down?
Chaos will tweak it. Iconoclasts and people who do things differently will thrive when there's uncertainty. Because when everything is hunky-dory and things are going well, there's really no incentive to do things differently or think really out of the box. And for the record, I hate that expression, because if you say thinking out of the box, you're most certainly in it. But as far as conditions that foster iconoclasm, I think organizations and institutions can take some very specific measures to foster it, if that's what they want. And it's not necessarily good for kind of all institutions. You know, for in politics, for example, as much as we would probably all like change, I think that's we're just giving lip service to that. In fact, we don't really want change in the government. That would just be complete chaos. We just want a little nudge.
Except when the market's going through the floor and everybody wants to change that. Except when an economy is, you know, feels in such trouble, people want to change that.
Well, that's exactly the type of circumstance where true iconoclasts can kind of rise to the surface, because what happens is there's kind of so much noise now in the environment. There's so much uncertainty. There's less profit to be made and less benefit for sticking with the status quo. So this gets back to the role of novelty. Novelty will, you know, kick people's perceptions out of autopilot. You know, it'll start getting more people thinking differently, and it creates an environment where, you know, the true iconoclasts and innovators, you know, can actually gain some purchase because people are more willing to change.
But can chaos work the other way? To come back to dopamine, which you've looked at before, you're saying in this book that there's biological evidence that points to dopamine as a key player in innovation and iconoclasm. Now, can chaos get people or societies to hunker down? Chaos doesn't sound like something that will bring that, you know, pleasurable dopamine streaming out, at least from what little I know.
You're right. And this was the realization I had on my first book, when people said they don't like novelty. And the thing with dopamine is that it's not directly related to pleasure. I mean, the thing that dopamine is really doing is, think of it as the fuel injector for action of the brain. It's released whenever you have to do something, usually in response to something in the environment, and oftentimes it's in response to trying to get something that you like. But it can also work the other direction. It will sometimes be released when something has happened, you're threatened, and you have to take an action in order to avoid it. So it's really kind of the fuel injector. It's the grease of action. And, you know, you can get it through novelty. It's very effective. But the thing is, you also kind of have a negative state associated with that. And people don't generally like that, except for this, you know, 10% or so of people who seem to really thrive on it.
Or for that portion of the population which has more dopamine running, which you point out, are the young. And some iconoclasts, like Steve Jobs, who's been incredibly successful in innovation, in part because he has targeted his innovation on the young. They've got, you know, they got the earbuds in, and they're the ones who are snapping up the innovation he produces. They're chemically, what ready for it.
That's right. So one of the things that I argue is that by looking at what happens to dopamine in the course of a lifetime, as well as across individuals, we can understand who might or might not be receptive to new ideas and be the more likely to innovate. And one of the things you realize very quickly when you start looking at what happens to brain systems is, especially dopamine, they peak in adolescence. You know, sometime between probably the ages of about 13 and 25, let's say, maybe 30, to be generous, the dopamine system, like many systems in the brain, is just going gangbusters. Mm. And we think that has a lot to do with the drive during adolescence and young adulthood to kind of go out and kind of make one's own life story and seek out new experiences and try new things. You know, and then with time, you know, as time goes on, slip into the 30s, 40s, and on, the dopamine system starts declining in its activity. We don't have that many dopamine neurons in the brain. It's only probably about 30 or 40,000 of them, which is really less than 1% of the brain. But you absolutely need them. If you don't have them, then you have Parkinson's disease. And that is kind of the quintessential state of inaction, the inability to kind of get up and do something.
Well, I'm doing my best to keep mine up and at 'em. Let's go to Barbara in Chesapeake, Virginia. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a painter, mostly because I don't play very well with others.
Okay.
I do get out and teach, actually, and I always figure that when people come to me to learn that they actually do want to change something and they want to get away from a system, and I put them through a series of exercises designed not to teach them a system, but to help them to see, because I find that most people have absolutely no clue what they're really seeing. So it might be, let's say, drawing the hole that the Wile E. Coyote went through instead of the Wile E. Coyote, or a lot of mirroring exercises or value exercises.
Or painting the Hallmark sunset instead of the one that's really right in front of them, perhaps.
You're going to laugh. I have a sunrise painting on the easel in front of me. But anyway, but the bottom line is, so many times I get a student, and I'm thinking they want the change, and I see it working. I mean, I see the eureka moment, and then I literally see them flee in terror. I mean, I'm not kidding. I've had ladies walk out of my class and say, oh, I feel like I'm drunk, or, oh, I feel like I'm on a roller coaster.
It's too scary to really see
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's working. You can get them past it through an exercise, and the people who stick with it, it's amazing how much you can learn in terms of turning on that part of your brain and integrating it with the rest of your life. And they'll say, oh, I never know. I can't see anything the same way again, et cetera. But so many people, it's like terror. Just, I mean, abject terror. And I need to know how to get past that.
Dr. Burns, how do you predispose people to, you know, to welcome seeing things fresh instead of walking out feeling drunk and running away?
That's a great story. And, you know, I mean, the things that you just described are kind of so stereotypical of the fear response and how the brain, you know, what the knee-jerk reaction is to novelty. On the one hand, we need novelty to learn and grow and, you know, grow as individuals and grow new synapses. But then on the other hand, you know, you've got this other part of the brain that says, no, stop, that's dangerous. I don't know what's going to happen. The best way to get through that, and I think the story actually is good because it points out that people can change. Some people are naturally better at it than others, but I think everyone has the capacity to change a little bit, and how much is entirely up to them. One of the things that's probably the most effective is you have to tamp down that fear response. You have to tamp down the amygdala. That's the amygdala firing. And the prefrontal cortex is the way to do that. You have to, you know, like I said, you have to make lemonade. You have to acknowledge the fear. You have to frame
it. But what helps that to happen? We don't come with an instruction manual for tamping down the amygdala, or if that's what you're – I mean, does information help, or is information frightening? Is there an attitude that, advocates of innovation like Barbara, let's say, could bring to those they're working with that would help them?
Usually what happens – and humans are not – unique in this respect. Any animal will do this. In a time of fear, they will look to their peers. They will see how other people are responding as a guide on what to do. I mean, that is a completely natural response when you're afraid and you're uncertain. So the key then is to create the environment where, you know, there's calmness there, so you don't want everyone freaking out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to help. That's what you see on Wall Street, people freaking out, they look to their peers and, you know, they do what everyone else is doing because they're afraid they're going to be the odd one out.
Is this where leadership and vision come in? If a strong or good communicator, leader can put out a vision that people can attach that higher mind to and be, drawn to, comforted by, organize their thoughts around? Is that part of it?
Yes, it is absolutely the role of leadership. And I think what you're hearing in your viewers and what, you know, we're hearing time and again is that's what people want. That's what we want from our leaders. And that, you know, reminds me of a quote from Martin Luther King.
Mm.
Great leader, very inspiring. He said, "The soft-minded man always fears change. He feels security in the status quo, and he has an almost morbid fear of the new. For him, the greatest pain is the pain of a new idea." And that's the kind of leader that people want. They want someone who's going to face down fear, face down uncertainty, and set an example.
What do you think, Doc? Do you feel readiness in this country, this culture, for innovation, change, or the hunker down fear response?
My sense is both are going on right now. And what we're witnessing is kind of an epic battle between courage and fear.
Wow. Right in our laps. And with a whole new bucket of ideas to help us think about it. Gregory Burns, it's been really interesting speaking with you. I'm grateful for your research, and thank you for sharing it. The new book is Iconoclast, A Neuroscientist Reveals How to Think Differently. Dr. Burns in Atlanta, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll go out with a little Jimi Hendrix, Never Afraid to Be the Iconoclast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.